Thank you, George, for your overgenerous introduction. It's a pleasure to appear on this geriatric panel. If wisdom is an attribute of age, our palsied presence ought to add a distinctive note to this meeting of the Philadelphia Society. Renovatio, Renaissance, Reformation, Restoration, Renewal, the very variety of these terms aiming at the reclamation of a functional and noble past ought to indicate the persistence of a problem characteristic of the whole of human history. The fact, of course, raises yet another important question. Does historical experience yield us knowledge useful in our confrontation with the future? Is there such a thing as a usable past? The extraordinary but now nearly forgotten Robert C. Binkley, once teacher, historian, bon vivant extraordinary here at Western Reserve University in Cleveland, once observed that the experience of history was like driving down an unknown country road at night and in reverse. The only thing one can see is a road over which one has already driven. A more famous and a more dangerous philosopher, now slowly sinking into the dustbin of history, already quoted today, observed, as you all know, that history never teaches us anything, but that history never teaches us anything. If we're discussing knowledge of future events, these two observations are accurate. If, however, we're content with insight rather than knowledge, these two observations are of limited value. After all, wisdom lies in insight rather than knowledge. Knowledge always has a tragic dimension, as when Eve picked the apple. Insight, on the other hand, leads to understanding. Insight into the formation of culture or cultures, what we English speakers mistakenly call civilization, leads to the recognition that culture can exist only where there are clearly defined hierarchical, political, religious, and intellectual structures, a clear division of labor, and an articulated class system. Rousseau and Marx, to the contrary, notwithstanding, culture can exist only under such conditions. When these hierarchical and class structures decay, the culture, the order, political, spiritual, and intellectual, to which they have given rise, decays with them. The end of the Old Kingdom in Egypt is a classic example, and it was not until the chaos of the first intermediate period in Egyptian history that the peoples of the Nile Valley, till after that intermediate period, that the peoples of the Nile Valley resumed their civilizational course. The same historical description applies to the Maya and the mound-building cultures of the Mississippi Valley. The European experience, from the Greeks to the French Revolution, to Stalin, to Hitler, and to the gutter society created by Fidel Castro, all provide insights into the same fundamental experience. Anthropologists, sociologists, and so-called social historians have attempted in the course of the last century to assert that there is a great mystery as to the origins of culture. That is so. Pardon me, That is so far as we can discern, culture is the natural outgrowth of biological and material abundance. That kings, priests, and poets are parasites who intrude themselves on the equality, primitive promiscuity, and shared abundance of an undifferentiated society. Cultural materialism, still dominant in the universities, is the political craze of outmoded academicians. Political leadership possessed of a creative political and cultural vision is the source of culture. It's the only source. It is the vision thing, as the elder George Bush once haplessly remarked. The suppression of internal violence, the articulation of society through the allocation of role and the division of labor, and defeat of challenges, usually barbaric looting parties such as the Islamic invaders of Spain and France and the Hungarians, who in 955 were defeated at the Battle of Lex, are important, though inadequate, to the formation of culture. The elder George Bush was right. It is the vision thing. In the course of the last several years, I have been studying the creation of Europe by Charlemagne and Otto the Great. These extraordinary men of the 9th and 10th centuries had a vision that went well beyond the establishment of political power. Theirs was the vision of a new and Christian Rome, secured by large temporal and spiritual, and fostered by patronage of the arts and letters. Their vision was essentially one of the renewal, spiritual and political, of the Roman past, which had become a vague and ghostly presence. It was a renewal which could be achieved only through the joint vision of a political and intellectual elite. Those elites, moreover, saw themselves in the service of a spiritual, a religious ideal. The notion, so widespread in our society, that our culture can derive wholly from secular concerns, that we can continue as a functioning culture with total indifference to religion, is belied by the human experience. When the gods die, men follow quickly in their wake. Aristocracy, the rule of the best, the aristos, is the key to the creative, to the creation and sustenance of culture. That aristocracy need not, more often than not, is not hereditary. It does depend upon the recruitment of the best into the political, social, religious, and intellectual elites of any society. Democracy is its radical alternative. I underline, democracy is its radical alternative. The drive for equality of condition and political power, the democratization of taste, as in contemporary television and the cinema, the reign of gutter opinion is always a forerunner of social and political degeneration. When the President of the United States is a little Abner, and his wife a dog patch Lady Macbeth, when our humanistic intellectuals have not yet gone beyond the cliches of vulgar Marxism, when the bishops of the Catholic Church are as Winston Churchill said in another context, they're the sorts of fellows who give pederasty a bad name. When this condition exists, we're in trouble. The quest for aristocracy, the protection of unequal political power, and the preservation of unequal properties are essential elements in the American political tradition. Let's forget all this crap about democracy. The fear of democracy was one of the most important elements in the American founding. Read John and Abigail Adams on this subject. Alexis de Tocqueville is a handbook. His Democracy in America is a handbook of methods to prevent the usurpation of power and the theft of property by democracy. Of the four great Bostonian historians of the 19th century, three of them, Prescott, Parkman, and Henry Adams, were anti-democratic. Of the American, the same is true, of course, of the American novelist James Fenimore Cooper, who was a most radical conservative and anti-democratic. The evidence, I believe, to be clear and irrefutable that without dedicated political, religious, social, and intellectual elites, cultures cannot be created, sustained, or revived. Marxists are fond of arguing that historically authentic culture is the work of the creative masses. Gene Brooker, my fellow participant of more than 50 years ago in Charles Odegaard's seminar on the 10th century, wrote in his recent book, Florence, the Golden Age, 1138 to 1737, Berkeley published it in 98. Here I quote him, though an elitist interpretation of urban experience is not palatable to our age of mass society, and he has mass society in quotation marks, so hostile to aristocratic traditions and values, it is supported, in the case of Florence, by massive evidence, both visual and documentary. But just as there is no room in this description of human reality for crackpot democracy, so there is no room for an elite of Nietzschean, Superman, criminal types who impose their decadent wills upon their fellow men. Noblesse oblige, nobility obligates. All culture is dependent upon a service aristocracy whose lives are devoted to the realization of their ideals and the service of their fellow men. This does not mean that they must be animated by a false humility, which they wear, as Benjamin Franklin did, as a suit of Quaker brown. The lower orders are only too willing to acknowledge heroism, saintliness, and commanding intelligence. The problem of our time is not that men are crying out for leadership. The problem of our time is that men are crying out for leadership in an age when very little leadership exists. And here let me underline something terribly important in this whole question of renovation, of renewal, of renaissance, of reform. That is, when we think to return to an older tradition, when we think to return to a classic past, We must remember that history is a one-way street, and it does not repeat itself, so that there can be no real restorations. What happens in that moment of return is an activation of the spirit that produces new forms. I'm very interested, for example, in neo-Gothic architecture. The whole medieval revival of the late 18th and 19th century. The great buildings produced by Augustus Welby Pugin, by Violette Leduc, and in America by Ralph Adams Cram, are buildings which are medieval in spirit. Indeed, they are even medieval in technique, but they are extraordinarily contemporary and extraordinarily creative and very different from the structures of the medieval past. We just spent a day recently visiting the wonderful Gothic Revival buildings in the city of Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh has more great Gothic Revival buildings than any other city in the United States. Go to Pittsburgh and see them. Beginning with, of course, Ralph Adams Cram's Liberty Street Presbyterian Church, which is a Gothic cathedral. I mean, it's higher than high church for Presbyterians. This is something quite shocking. I suppose it didn't bother the Mellons. The Calvary Episcopal Church, again designed by Ralph Adams Cram, is a beautiful building, but it is not really medieval. Hines Chapel on the University of Pittsburgh is a building that has a grandeur like that of Sainte Chapelle in Paris, but it isn't really medieval. The Cathedral of Learning on the campus of the University of Pittsburgh intends to be an adaptation of medieval architecture to the modern skyscraper, before, of course, the Tribune Tower in Chicago. It's not medieval. It's new and very different. So what I'm telling you is that the Spirit works in its own way in reviving the past. It will lead to a new creation. Remember that Americans thought in the American Revolution that they were reclaiming, reinstituting their rights and liberties as Englishmen. But what they did was to create a new order of the ages. It is... It is well to recognize that technological sophistication is not culture. And indeed, in the absence of genuine culture, the hand will eventually lose its cunning. Reason will lose its spiritedness, and love will lose its ability to bind men together. At the present time, elites are in decay, and compelling ideals, the vision thing, or vision things, I should say, do not reach beyond the grossest animal satisfactions. humankind wants to believe. It is high time that conservatives raise their sights above libertarianism and the market.